This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Chevron proposed a project that it said was a modernization, but when we got a chance to look at it, we found that in fact they were proposing to expand all the types of equipment that would be needed to refine a fundamentally different lower quality types or grades of crude oil.
Richmond, California is one of the many communities in America where economic and environmental injustice intersect. A waterfront city in the San Francisco Bay Area, you might expect it to be dominated by affluence and comfort, but you'd be mistaken. Back in 1901, Standard Oil moved in and built what currently operates as the Chevron Richmond Refinery. And since then, the city of Richmond has literally grown up in the shadow of the smokestacks. Chevron has not been the most responsible of neighbors, and those of us who've lived in the Bay Area for a while can't help but associate Richmond with chemical leaks and warnings for residents not to leave their homes. But today's guest on Sea Change Radio has an inspiring story of a community coming together to blow back at the smokestack. Greg Karas is a senior scientist at Communities for a Better Environment, an organization that advocates for working-class communities like Richmond that don't have the money or political influence to fight big oil by themselves. I'm joined now by Greg Karas. He's a senior scientist at Communities for a Better Environment. Greg, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be here.
Why don't you first give us a little bit of a history for our listeners around the country who are not familiar with the mix of people in Richmond, California?
So Richmond, California is a small city, about 100,000 people, across the bay from San Francisco. And it's now distinguished as being, I believe, the biggest city in North America with a Green Party mayor. That's new. The city, just in the last election, elected a progressive majority. It has been a company town throughout its history. And the Chevron refinery, actually it was Standard Oil California Refinery Number 1, is located there. As you might expect, the kind of rail yard, shipping, port, and other heavy industrial facilities that would grow up around such a big complex. This is now the Chevron Richmond Refinery. It's the largest refinery in Northern California, and it's owned by the largest oil company in California. Chevron is the largest refiner in California when you include their El Segundo refinery down south. So Richmond...
The population is
about 100,000 people. And this population is multicultural, but it's largely low-income communities of color. And those communities are slammed up against the refinery and the industrial belt. Perhaps for that reason, and also because it was an organizing center for the Porter Coleman's union, the first black union in America, the railcar, the Porter's Workers Union, it's a cradle of the environmental justice movement. Richmond has a large African-American population that came in to build the ships in World War II from mainly Louisiana, Mossville, Calcasieu Parish. Our members still have great connections with their relatives in Louisiana. Large and growing Latino population. Many of our members are Latino. And a very large, a great portion of the diaspora from the Indochinese Wars. The Laotian Organizing Project of APEN is a wonderful representative.
APEN stands for?
Asian Pacific Environmental Network, one of our close allies in Richmond. Their Laotian Organizing Project is housed there in Richmond because of the large population of Asian immigrants.
So give us a snapshot of the amount of refineries functioning still in the U.S. and how the Richmond refinery would fit into that matrix.
The U.S. is the largest refining country in the world by a large margin. And California is the refining center of the American West. It's the west of the Rocky Mountains. California's got roughly three quarters of the total refining capacity in the continent. refineries in the United States are pretty advanced from the by industry standards. They squeeze more gasoline out of a barrel of oil. They're more complex. They're more efficient from the industry's point of view at making profitable products out of oil. That also takes more energy, and it emits more pollutants. In California, that's especially true. Probably most people who follow energy at all know that the oil companies now are the biggest corporations that the planet has ever seen. There's been a tremendous amount of consolidation since the antitrust breakup of U.S. Oil interests a century ago. And as part of that consolidation, smaller refineries have been closing while companies buy up smaller oil companies to expand. They close down the small refineries, expand the larger ones. The larger ones are getting bigger. So over decades, the oil industry is in the U.S. has seen a large reduction in the number of refineries while the total refining capacity has increased. There are about 130, 140 refineries in the U.S., and their total capacity is bigger than, say, 1980, when there was a much larger number of refineries.
And you and several of your ally organizations have been in a multi-year struggle with Chevron and the refinery to try to stop the transformation of the refinery to be able to refine a lower grade oil. Why don't you give us a little background on
right.
this?
Right. To understand this, you have to put yourself in the shadow of the smokestacks, where our community members, the people who actually run the program in our organizations, live. These are areas, they're low-income communities of color. They're historically disadvantaged, disempowered. And they're in places like Richmond, where there's a concentration of high emission, low jobs industry. The fossil fuel industries, and this is U.S. Bureau of Census data, fossil fuel industries provide roughly 10 times fewer jobs per dollar economic activity, gross revenue, than the average of all businesses in the total economy. And many of your listeners may know this, that the green parts of the economy actually are more jobs intensive per dollar. In Richmond, industrial emissions on a per capita basis are 10 times, up to 10 times the average regionally or statewide. The emissions and the flaring, the incidents, repeated acute exposure incidents, and then just the major pollutant, CO2, greenhouse gases. The Chevron refinery in Richmond is, by its own data, the largest industrial greenhouse gas emitting facility in California. So if you live near it and you think about all the other combustion products that come out from burning fossil fuels along with that CO2, there's certainly exposure hotspots. We see that in the pandemic childhood asthma rates, adult onset asthma rates, the whole plethora of pollution-related impacts. And research that we've done with academics shows that this is actually accumulating in people's homes, where particulate matter that's been chemically fingerprinted to the refinery and to heavy oil burning at the port are reaching higher levels, indoors even, than outdoors in Richmond. These are levels that are higher than control sites that are upwind away from the industries. And more than half the households in our peer-reviewed survey of communities near the refinery had fine particulate matter levels inside the house that exceeded the state health standard.
Why the disproportionate impact on communities of color, Greg?
We know a lot about this. The short answer is that disempowered communities become dumping grounds for high-profit, low-jobs, high-pollution industries. And that is, of course, becoming a problem for everyone as we struggle to get beyond oil, and oil is entrenched in the most disempowered communities, and then the gasoline impacts all of us. But it's a matter of environmental rights and environmental racism in low-income communities of color. Has been for a long time. It's not that It's not that the communities are moving because they want to be near the refinery. It's that the dirtiest of our industries, and it turns out the ones that are providing the least jobs, are being put in the dumping grounds. And communities like Richmond are fighting to no longer be a dumping ground.
There must be something in the way I feel that she don't want me to feel. Starship bears a cut me.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Greg Karas. He's a senior scientist at Communities for a Better Environment. Greg, you mentioned the impact and the health impact of the Chevron refinery on its Richmond and the community near the refinery and how they've been up till now. But what Chevron was proposing to do would actually make these hazards even more hazardous.
Right. There's an unacceptable level of pollution, environmental risk, environmental impact in the low-income communities of color near the refinery now. And as a result, the community for decades has been trying to push the company to modernize its equipment, to use modern, more efficient, less polluting equipment that's become available over the decades that in some cases many decades, the existing large pieces of equipment have been in operation. They should be modernized. Chevron proposed a project that it said was a modernization, but when we got a chance to look at it, we found that, in fact, they were proposing to expand all the types of equipment that would be needed to refine fundamentally different lower quality types or grades of crude oil.
So the environmental impact report that they first filed was approved because it met the fairly low threshold standards for California, correct? And then when it went under further scrutiny, the larger impact of what this could be was not addressed in the environmental impact report. And that's kind of what your group and your allies pushed to understand a little bit more of the 9,000 foot view of what the overhaul would actually mean in terms of long-term effects on the community.
Yeah, the EIR, environmental impact report, in California is a document that is supposed to describe the project adequately for environmental review, to identify and analyze the potential environmental impacts, and then to where a significant potential impact or impacts are identified, to analyze ways to lessen or avoid them, to mitigate them. That's what it's supposed to do. We found out that Chevron's EIR did not do any of those things because it did not describe the project adequately in the first place. It described the project as a modernization for efficiency. And what it in fact would have done is to expand the refinery's capacity to refine a different feedstock that in a way that would increase pollution potentially dramatically.
So it was more efficient, but that wasn't. But if you change the input into it, that efficiency is offset pretty quickly.
Yeah, we now know from our peer-reviewed follow-up research in the years since that first discovery that across the country and in California, refineries that are refining denser, higher sulfur crude oil are emitting up to 2 to 3 times more greenhouse gases per barrel refined. We have, through other research, found that their emissions of other pollutants, such as discharges of selenium to San Francisco Bay, can be 10 to 40 times greater per barrel refined, depending on the crude oil. So, as you might expect, the type of material you put into the machine can have a driving effect on how much emissions comes out. that effect could be mitigated to some extent by more efficient equipment, more capture technology, but it's limited. If we go to the wrong way to fundamentally even dirtier forms of crude oil, it's very much analogous to switching back to coal in power plants. It overwhelms or can overwhelm the new treatment technology, and you can come up with an increase in emissions. And as I said, across the country, if we go to tar sands, we're talking 2 to 3 times more emissions from refining on top of a roughly equal increase in emissions from just getting the oil out of the ground.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Greg Karas. He's a senior scientist at Communities for a Better Environment. So you talked about externalizing costs from the industry perspective. Let's talk about the externalities created by refineries and the at-risk communities that are affected most by them. How does an organization like Communities for a Better Environment fight for these people, and what kind of chance do they have to have cleaner water and air living under, as you say, the shadow of a smokestack?
CBE is unique in being in a community-based environmental justice organization that has scientists and lawyers as well as organizers on staff. But we're not unique in this way. Like other community-based organizations, we follow our members' leadership. People who and families in the shadow of the smokestacks are motivated primarily by protecting their families' health and livelihoods. The externalities you mention look to us like more cancer, more asthma, more spills, fires and explosions and flaring, dirty air, having to rush to the emergency room in the middle of the night because our kid's having another asthma attack, too many funerals, too many good people, friends and family members who are leaving us too soon with cancer and related illnesses. And so Richmond's not unique in this way. Communities that are most impacted by the pollution from fossil fuel industries are fighting hardest to protect our health. This is where you see the new rules that the EPA periodically takes credit from really starting. Like with flaring. Landmark flare control rule in the Bay Area in 2005, now it's spreading nationally. EPA just announced.
First, explain what flaring is and why it's a bad thing.
Flaring is burning off gases, excess gases in the open air. In a refinery, it's supposed to be a safety device. And these very large, high pressure, high temperature process vessels, process reactions run out of control. They can escalate quickly. They can explode. People have died. And it also destroys infrastructure that makes the industry money.
Why does the industry do it? What, from an efficiency standpoint?
First of all, keep in mind that the oil industry is all about keeping the flow going from the well to the gas pump. So there's tremendous profit motivation to keep units in operation, to run them pedal to the metal when gasoline demand is high, when there's a problem, to get them back up and running as quickly as possible the same day if you can get away with it without destroying the unit. And so when they overpressure, and that could cause destruction to the unit as well as kill your workers if it explodes or releases gases, they burn them off. That's flaring. They flare off the excess gases. You can be releasing hundreds of tons of hazardous materials and pollutants into the air in a matter of minutes from one of these process units if you don't burn them off. If you burn them off, you may burn off 50, even 95% of that to carbon dioxide and reduce the impact on your workers, but the emissions are still causing acute exposures in the community. That's flaring, and flaring is... If you see it, a big event can shake your house. It's loud. It's a ball of fire in the sky. It could look at night like the whole refinery's caught on fire, and the acute exposures to the emissions can be severe in some cases, even after the flaring. This happens repeatedly around refineries and oil fields. at refineries in the Bay Area, refiners were flaring at environmentally significant levels roughly weekly, about once a week on average, across the Bay Area for decades until the community rose up and said, and really forced the government agencies, the Air Quality Management District in this case, to address the problem. This happened in 2005 when the first comprehensive flare rule in the country was adopted. That flare rule, the industry's claim was that they would explode, they would blow up, that they would have to go out of business or be unsafe to comply. We said that flares should be used as emergency devices, but that if they were running the refineries properly, keeping them in balance, they would actually have less incidents, they would be safer, and they would flare less. Turns out we were right. Refineries across the Bay Area are flaring 10 times less than they used to. Chevron Richmond is flaring 10 times less than it used to. And while each time they flare, and they still do flare, there are still acute exposures to pollutants in the community. There's been a tremendous amount of progress, and this has become a model for the nation that grew out of this community of colors' resistance to the industry line that to keep the profits moving, to keep the oil moving, we absolutely have to flare. It turns out that just wasn't true.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures
of... Sea Change Radio is sponsored by Redwood Hill Farm, a family-owned and operated award-winning humane-certified goat dairy farm and organic creamery located in Sonoma County, California. Go to redwoodhill.com to learn more about Redwood Hill Farm's extensive line of natural goat milk dairy products. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Greg Karras. He's a senior scientist at Communities for a Better Environment. What's the status quo mean for a Chevron Richmond refinery?
Yeah, well, part of our proposal for protecting our health now and moving over time to a green energy economy in Richmond is, with respect to the type of oil refined, to do nothing different from what they're doing now. We think that's very reasonable for a couple of reasons. One, it's cheaper. They don't have to invest in as much equipment or as much fuel to burn the oil. Two, whatever side of the peak oil debate that you come down on, everyone is acknowledging that for a refinery the size of Chevron Richmond, that there are decades of conventional oil that are available. Chevron's refining oil largely from Saudi Arabia and Iraq now. It's conventional oil by industry definition. And that resource is not going away next year. It's not going away in 5 years. There are decades of conventional oil that are available to U.S. refineries if they choose to use them. And the third piece of that is the reason that we need to be accelerating the growth of alternative energy, including in transportation, now, not tomorrow, but today. It will take decades, and unless we want to sacrifice our climate and our health to what would only be an increase in total global climate emissions, rather than the kinds of drastic cuts that we need, we are going to have to move beyond and just leave that fundamentally dirtier oil in the ground. If the industry starts planning for that now, 30 years from now, it can be diversified. And it needs to be diversified in communities like Richmond where we don't have enough jobs. So the basic deal we're proposing is make your refinery state-of-the-art, as least polluting as you can now. Do not switch to the dirtier oil, and we will work with you to transform over decades to the green jobs economy that you can be a part of if you want to.
Do you have any idea of what percentage of an average refinery like Richmond, what percentage of those workers are local hires?
The Richmond refinery, there was testimony last Tuesday that that roughly 7% of the jobs at that refinery are held by people who live in Richmond.
I'm betting those 7% are not the highest paid jobs.
Right. It gets worse, though. The refining in general, and this is true statewide and has been for decades, it provides less jobs per dollar gross revenue than any other sector, and about 10 times less than the average for all sectors combined statewide. There just aren't many jobs. There are about 400, 500 operating jobs at the Richmond refinery. Less jobs per acre, less jobs per dollar, and most of those jobs, well, you know, they're industrial jobs, they're blue-collar jobs, they're relatively high-paying, maybe averaging 50, 60,000 a year. Most of those jobs are held by people who don't live in the community. This is part of the problem of environmental injustice, is that we get blight. Some of that blight is because of the direct impacts of the pollution, and some of that blight is because the profitable, yes, but highly polluting industries are low jobs industries. The money doesn't go to the workers. There aren't as many jobs. And so communities like Richmond that have a concentration of high emission, low jobs, fossil industries get it both ways. That we get the cumulative impacts, which, and this is cumulative impacts on our health, of blight, joblessness, and higher levels of pollution exposure. Right. There are cases in some of our communities, people couldn't sell their houses when the refinery started blowing up and spewing too often. The real estate prices went through the floor and they were stuck. They were trapped right in the pollution zone. This does happen. This is the real problem. This is the front line of a problem that's affecting our global climate. Now, I don't know if you want to ask it again, but it is relevant, this is true beyond the oil industry. I mean, Detroit said that if they had to have seatbelts in their cars by federal mandate in the 60s, that it would kill the industry. Turned out what really hurt the industry was not having adequate fuel efficiency standards when the price of oil got too high. The oil industry is now doing the same thing. They said that, you know, refineries said they would close if they had to reduce their flaring. That wasn't true. Tosco in Avon threatened to close if they were required to reduce their dioxin emissions. That wasn't true. They'd already sold the refinery to another company. And now Chevron is just now making that same job killer argument. Of course, this is a false argument. We not only can have jobs and environmental protection, the green economy provides more jobs per dollar. And yet, it's, I suppose, to be expected that an industry trying to protect its market share that knows very well that it is in competition with other industries that are using fundamentally cleaner energy resources, it, I guess, can be expected to try to make the argument that it's good for your job. That may be true on the short term for a worker that doesn't have a retraining program. And so to me, the real question is, when are we going to create that jobs to work track in the green economy? We know there's more jobs. Where's the investment? Where's the retraining program so refinery workers have job security? That's also a matter of environmental justice.
Greg Karas, Senior Scientist for Communities for a Better Environment. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Fela Kuti, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Gil Scott-Heron. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.